Say it once, say it twice, we will not put up with ice. Say it once, say it twice, we will not put up with ice.
Kiara, wait, what's with the slogan shouting?
Disha, my friend, you've been living under a rock. Haven't you heard about the No Tech for Ice campaign?
No, I haven't heard of this campaign. What is it all about, and why are you shouting slogans like we're at a protest?
Okay, fasten your seatbelt, Disha, because we're diving into the wild but under-narrated story of digital technology and racist surveillance. But first, let's welcome everyone who's tuned in.
Welcome, podcast people, to yet another episode of CRT Two. I am Disha, and joining me is the slogan-shouting Kiara. Today, we are unraveling the mysteries behind the No Tech for Ice campaign. That's got law schools buzzing. Right, Kiara?
Absolutely, Disha. We're putting on our investigative hats and delving into the tech storm. Companies building tools to surveil, incarcerate, and deport racial minorities.
So tell us, Kiara, what is this No Tech for Ice campaign and why is it creating so much noise?
The No Tech for Ice campaign is a movement built by law students and tech wizards, exposing how technology companies are tangled up in criminal justice and immigration enforcement.
And today we're not just winging it, right, Kiara? We've got a rock star guest, Sarah Lambden, who has cracked the code on legal database giants and tech companies. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lambden, and I'm a professor of law at CUNY School of Law in New York City. And I also am the author of the book Data Cartels, which looks into data brokers like the ones we're going to discuss today.
Sarah, tell us, how did this whole campaign kick off?
Yeah, that's a great question. So No Tech for ICE is a really well-organized campaign that began with three, actually, immigration rights advocacy groups. So it began with an organization called Mi Gente and Jacinta Gonzalez there. And then she joined with the Immigrant Defense Project here in New York City. And then they came together with a legal rights group called Just Futures Law that also focuses on immigration rights. So I feel like No Tech for ICE is actually pretty amazing because they did the first work to look at the ICE surveillance program, DHS surveillance program, and unpack which companies are actually contributing their technology and their data stores to this surveillance enterprise. Because ICE and DHS have maybe the biggest digital surveillance program of government agencies outside of the NSA, the National Security Agency. So they've done amazing work researching and kind of teasing out which companies are supplying their tech to ICE.
Kiara, my partner in crime, help me out here, please. What in the world is ICE?
ICE, my friend, stands for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're the folks enforcing immigration laws, digging into customs violations, and handling all things related to immigration.
Okay, now it is making some sense. So my question to you, Sarah, is why is the legal community getting involved in this campaign? Why were law students calling upon our law school administration to cut ties with legal database giants like LexisNexis and Westlaw?
So the reason that law students and lawyers have gotten involved on kind of the tech company side is because, partly because of my research. In 2017, I was a law librarian at CUNY School of Law, and I saw a news article that was about the companies that were helping to build the ICE surveillance program. So two intrepid journalists had done a FOIA request and gotten a list of all of the people who attended something called an ICE Investor Day, which is a meeting that ICE held in order to kind of teach. It was like a teach-in for all of these tech companies about ICE's quote-unquote extreme vetting program, which was an intensive surveillance program that was introduced by the Trump administration. So this was 2017, right after Trump had been elected. ICE was in the news a lot for being especially, bad, doing bad things. Not that this was the first time that ICE had ever done anything bad, or not that these weren't ongoing problems, but really things had gotten so egregious that a lot of news reporters were reporting out about things that ICE were doing. So ICE was in the news a lot, and these tech companies were helping ICE, or bidding to help ICE, build even more invasive data surveillance. And I was surprised as a law librarian because I saw on the FOIA list that representatives from LexisNexis and Thomson Reuters, which is Westlaw's parent company, were listed on the list of potential tech companies that were vying to help build this extreme vetting program. And that made me and some other law librarians concerned. And me as a law librarian, I knocked on the door of the law librarian in the office next to me, whose name is Yasmin Sokar Harker. And we decided to write a blog post for the American Association of Law Libraries website, just to kind of ask our colleagues, like, what's going on here? How are Lexis and Westlaw involved in ICE surveillance? And should we be concerned about this, given everything we're reading in the news? And the blog post was posted by another law librarian on the AAL website. And within 2 minutes, the blog post was taken down. And Wow. Yeah, it was replaced with just one sentence. It says, "This blog post was removed at the advice of counsel," or something like that, of legal counsel. And we were really startled by that, because librarians are very anti-censorship. And this felt like censorship, like we weren't being allowed to ask this question. And that made me so curious that I started researching to try to figure out how Thomson Reuters and LexisNexis were involved in government surveillance, what their role was. And along the way, one of the first entities I met was No Tech for ICE. And I became involved in No Tech for ICE and have been, you know, working alongside them and with them ever since.
Disha, I already feel like LexisNexis and Westlaw questions are coming. They're legal databases widely used by judges, lawyers, and law students to research cases, statutes, regulations, law journals, you name it. Think of these databases as giant digital libraries for almost anything you need to know about the law.
Sarah, what made you look into the activities of these tech companies like Relix and Thomson Reuters, who you've referred to in the past as data brokers? For our podcast pals, these are the companies that own legal research platforms that we just discussed.
Yeah. So what I learned when I started kind of unpacking this research, and I learned this because the companies don't make this clear to the lawyers who use their legal products. Like, this isn't something that's in their PR materials that they brag about. But it turns out that both Thomson Reuters and LexisNexis are huge informational empires. So read Elsevier, LexisNexis, or Relix. A sliver of what that company does is supply the LexisNexis legal research platform. And a sliver of what Thomson Reuters as a corporation provides is the Westlaw legal research platform, right? That's just one of their products. Their other products include other academic research products, financial research products, but one of the biggest products that they are expanding at the greatest rate, according to their annual financial filings, are their data broker companies. So what these companies have are huge stores of information, right? They have the entire corpus of US law, as we all know as lawyers, right? They have the most robust legal information products. They also have very robust news information products. They also have very robust academic information products and financial information products, right? We know this. What we didn't know before 2017 and before, you know, a lot of research by No Tech for ICE and me and other people happened was that these two companies are also some of the biggest data brokers to the United States government and to insurance companies, tenant screening companies, employment screening companies, healthcare systems. They are huge data brokers. So a data broker, there's no one set definition of data brokers. One of my first jobs, actually, when I started writing this out, was to define what a data broker was, because at the time, there wasn't a very good definition. So people like me and other scholars who study data brokers, like Justin Sherman and No Tech for ICE advocates, we've defined data brokers. And the umbrella of what is a data broker generally includes companies that stockpile personal data, data about people, right? And along with Thomson Reuters and LexisNexis, this huge legal information store warehouse, you know, along with their academic information warehouse, their financial information warehouse, they have among the largest personal data warehouses out there. And government agencies like ICE, insurance companies, healthcare system, et cetera, pay millions and millions of dollars to Thomson Reuters and Reed Elsevier, LexisNexis, and a few other companies to have access to all of our personal data. They have these very, very deep data dossiers about all of us. So in 2014, the FTC actually did some research and compiled a report about privacy and data brokers. And the authors of that report describe data brokers' dossiers as knowing more about ourselves than even our close friends and relatives know about us. And I would argue that your personal data dossier with LexisNexis or with Thomson Reuters is so robust that you don't even remember some of the information that's in them. Like, do you have all of your license numbers memorized? Do you remember the address of every place you've ever lived, every phone number you've ever had, every place you've ever been employed, the numbers of your credit cards, your insurance policies, et cetera, probably not. But your dossier knows all of these things. The average size of a person's personal data dossier, if it was printed on paper, is at a minimum 40 pages long. And they have those data dossiers for all of us. And they also collect every time we've been mentioned in the news or in a court filing, right? Or in an academic scholarship piece, because they also have all of those information warehouses.
What are the implications on the legal professions? This sounds really wild.
We do know that ICE uses the data dossiers that these companies have and runs them through a Palantir system. So Palantir is a predictive AI, I guess you would call it today. I don't know if we would have called it that in 2017, but a predictive AI company that does predictive policing, which is a data processor, some sort of, you know, algorithmic system that crunches through the data dossiers that LexisNexis or Thomson Reuters provides and makes lists of people and their associates and predicts how likely they are to, quote unquote, commit a crime or be somehow risky, right? What LexisNexis and Thomson Reuters really make their money off of as data brokers is risk assessment, assessing how, quote unquote, risky we all are, how likely we are to commit a crime, be a bad employee, commit fraud, right? And their products and the companies they work with purport to do those things.
So Sarah, you are saying that these data brokers are not just collecting and sharing our data through these data dossiers, but they're also predicting, analyzing our data, almost like playing data detectives for ICE.
So they do both, right? So one thing that they do is they partner or are partnered with by government agencies, companies that make algorithms, right? Or companies that make predictive systems. Because without robust collections of data, a predictive policing system is worthless, right? They need a lot of information about all of us in order to work, in order to draw up these predictions and make assumptions about us and know where we are and know what we look like, right? So that is one thing that these systems do. Another thing that these systems do or that happens with these systems is that they're paired with something I call designer data systems. So Clearview AI famously created this idea of a face print, right? Facial recognition technology that could recognize us walking down Broadway in the middle of New York City, right? It could pick out our face, recognize us, and then link us to all of this personal information about who we are, what we do, where we work, where we're going. That kind of system also relies on robust data dossiers. Like, what good is it to know that this is what my face looks like if you don't know anything else about me, right? So these systems also depend on robust data dossiers. So do geolocation systems that track where you're going or predict where you might go, right? All of these systems depend on kind of a fire hose of personal data in order to make these connections, in order to, you know, make these predictions. And that data has to be supplied by somebody. And a lot of times that somebody or that some entity is a LexisNexis type of entity or a Thomson Reuters type of entity.
At this point in the story, it's important to talk about the history of data broker companies. We have with us Mackenzie Funk, the author of the book called The Hank Show, which follows the life of Hank Asher, who helped create the data broker industry under the surveillance state. So, Mackenzie, how did these data broker companies come into existence?
There are perhaps three streams, and one of them was the credit agencies, who very early on, even in the 1800s, were going around on behalf of businesses and eventually banks to determine who should get credit. Like when you show up the corner store, should you have to pay right then, or should you be able to get a monthly tab? And they would go around and interview people's associates and try to get a profile of people. And this is the early days of Equifax, which was known as the retail credit company. And there's a long history of these for this very narrow use of checking out someone if they're credit worthy, of compiling a whole lot of information about them. And eventually it, of course, crossed lines. Are they a drinker? Is this woman dating people out of wedlock? There are all these histories from the history of looking into someone's credit history that you would think, okay, this actually isn't relevant. But for the most part, they stayed in their lane for a long time. That's one of it. The other one is marketing. For years and years, there were these companies that were compiling lists for marketing purposes or for election purposes. And they would basically say, who's going to be interested in our product? And these, again, were relatively narrow. They would get warranty cards or magazine subscription lists and say, okay, these people read, I don't know, Golf Digest or something. So you know they're into golf. And so they're selling that kind of information. And that became much more sophisticated as the years went on. But Hank Asher was the one who saw that both of those streams could be pulled together along with public records from the states and sold to something very different. And I'll tell you how he first got into that. And that is, he built a very powerful computer in Florida in the 80s and 90s and was using these systems to do programming jobs. And then someone finally came to him and said, hey, I want to make a database of all the vehicle registrations in Florida. Can you do that? And he said, sure. And he said, well, there's something like 30,000 records. And he said, no problem. And they went to the equivalent of the DMV in Florida, and they said, hey, we'd like to buy every vehicle registration. And the DMV said, no, you can't do that. And they said, yes, we can. Because the way that the open records laws were written, in Florida in particular, all these laws that go back to, you know, the idea that citizens should be able to know what their government is doing, were all written in a way that would allow someone like Hank Asher to go out and buy everything. And nobody had exploited it in that way like he had, but eventually it worked. He and his partner went and they got every vehicle registration. And then they made a product out of that to sell to insurance companies. And then they went out and got every driver's license in the state of Florida. And they used those together. And then soon they realized the floodgates opened. They could get every marriage license. They could get divorce records. They could get all sorts of real estate transaction records and fishing licenses, gun licenses. And it was built on these open records laws. And once they had their base of information, then they went out and they went to the Equifax of the world, or they went to TransUnion, and they said, hey, we know you've been collecting all this information on people's credit histories. Can you sell us just what's above the line? Which is to say, when someone changes their address, they always tell their bank, and then their bank will tell TransUnion. I mean, it's kind of the first thing people do. You might lapse on updating your driver's license, but you're definitely going to want to know where your money is. So they went to the big three credit unions, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and eventually were able to buy credit headers from them, which shows someone's current address and often contact information. They eventually were going to the marketing side and pulling down all this email information. And so they eventually tapped into these other streams. And of course, when the internet became a thing, because really when he started it wasn't, they were going into America Online, and then they were getting social identities and everything else you can imagine. But what I learned, obviously, was that this went way back before Facebook and everything else, what we think about with privacy laws. And a lot of what these clients of Hank Asher were talking, police departments and Fortune 500 companies and banks, what they're interested in is this very hard information, this hard data that you're not going to get from Facebook. They want to know really who is somebody and where do they live, and they want a relative fidelity with it. What Asher sold, although it's a lot of information, it's very well vetted. It's, imagine five different sources all saying, okay, their new address is this, or their phone number is this. That's the kind of information they wanted to get. And it snowballed from there, but that was the basis.
Whoa. So you're saying Hank Asher helped create a digital realm where the big brother can watch over all of us all the time?
Sounds like it. It's like living in a digital panopticon, where every move is under the watchful gaze of the unseen. The concept of the panopticon was developed by Jeremy Bentham and expanded by Foucault to describe the perfect prison. A panopticon is an institutional building designed to observe all inmates without the inmates being able to tell that they're being watched.
But this isn't just any digital panopticon, right, Kiara? It is the one that disproportionately profiles, restricts, tracks down black and brown bodies. It is the digital panopticon of race. How are tech companies involved in illegal, unconstitutional surveillance? And what is the racist twist to the surveillance story, Sarah?
Yeah, that's, I feel like, the most important question to ask and kind of the biggest conclusion to draw from all of this. So first, I want to just really briefly explain why you would call it illegal, because it seems like, you know, if ICE is doing it, if, you know, the NSA is doing it, if your local police agency is doing it, how can it be illegal? And one of the main legal issues raised when government entities use these products is that these products skirt Fourth Amendment requirements, right? They skirt obligations that the government has, or that any state actor has, to get a warrant before they conduct a search or seizure. And the way that these companies do that is the government never takes hold of the data set. What these companies do is they license a research product, a personal data research product, to ICE or to, you know, the FBI or to the NYPD. And if a state actor is just licensing a research product, that Fourth Amendment obligation, according to the third party doctrine and according to just kind of the idea of state actors that has been created by the courts interpreting that meaning, is that you don't have to get a warrant in order to use a research product, right? So that is kind of how these companies skirt Fourth Amendment requirements.
So the Fourth Amendment is like our privacy superhero, guarding our personal space. But wait, the bigger problem is that there are no constitutional safeguards, right, Kiara?
You're right. Devin Carbato argues that race-based policing and surveillance that is neither search nor seizure is constitutional and legal, and its constitutionality has been upheld by none other than the Supreme Court. Let's have a listen.
What does the Fourth Amendment protect us from? The Fourth Amendment protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the core protection. So if we pause and think about that for a minute, it requires for us to identify police conduct as a search or a seizure before the Fourth Amendment is even a game in town. So if the police interact with us in ways that don't amount to a search or a seizure, the Fourth Amendment has absolutely nothing to say about that. Why is that important? Because it means that forms of interaction that the Supreme Court concludes are neither searches or seizures are forms of interaction that don't require any justification.
So these tech wizards are helping the government predict crimes. So how does that impact Black and Brown communities, Sarah?
So there are two big issues with predictive data systems and the data that these companies sell. The first is algorithmic bias, and the second is data quality and data errors. So I'll start with algorithmic bias. All predictive policing and predictive algorithms and algorithms that are used in digital surveillance are created by humans. Humans are inherently biased. I don't want to take credit for this idea. I didn't do the research on this idea. This idea is well formulated by experts like Sophia Umoja Noble, who wrote Algorithms of Oppression, Ruha Benjamin, who's now written multiple books and reports on this topic, Virginia Eubanks, who wrote, I think it's called Algorithms of Inequality. There is a whole body of research. Notice it's all done by women and mostly women of color who've really, really shined light and done the in-depth, extensive expert research on proving that algorithmic bias is a known problem in predictive policing systems, right? So these systems have a tendency to draw up results that focus on over-policed communities, especially Black communities, Muslim communities, Latino and Latina communities, right? These systems are biased to focus on those systems and to draw up particular results that are biased. And then that problem is compounded by what LexisNexis and Thomson Reuters and other data brokers provide, which is biased and erroneous data. So the data that these companies provide is notoriously erroneous. Like, I don't know if anybody could open up their own data dossier and find zero errors or mistakes. Every time that you've entered a wrong number on a credit card application, or somebody's misheard you and misspelled the name of your street, or if you have the same name as somebody else or have lived at the same address as somebody else and that data has been conflated, that all gets put in the records that these systems use, right? Because the government purchases this data wholesale and uses it in the form that it's in. It's noteworthy that LexisNexis and Thomson Reuters, on their data dossiers, they actually put a disclaimer saying, do not use this data to make big decisions because this data has not been vetted and might contain errors, right? And then people who buy or license these research products use the data anyway. We know that the data is erroneous. And the data isn't just erroneous, like it has mistakes, it's also biased. So who has disproportionately large police records? Who has to seek more government services, which leads to more government records? You know, who has to disproportionately use SNAP or is involved with Child Protective Services or has been in some sort of landlord-tenant dispute, right? There are certain communities and certain groups of people who have been disproportionately over-policed and disproportionately over-interacted with Child Protective Service, right? Child Protective Service tends to focus on communities of color and disproportionately target those families. So that leads to much more robust data sets for those people who have, you know, if your rap sheet, if your criminal, you know, if your criminal history is really long, that's all in your data dossier. Now your data dossier is 10 pages longer, and it is more likely to make you look like somebody who might commit a crime in the future. And that is the result of human bias making its way into these data sets. So there's algorithmic bias, there's data bias, and there are just plain old data errors that all impact these results and make them problematic.
Do you think such racist surveillance and policing practices are new and contemporary to the digital tech era? I mean, what kind of predictive policing and surveillance practices have preceded the digital era?
Yeah, these systems perpetuate old systems and are built on old systems, right? The digital predictive policing outcome is predicated on old records, paper records, computer records from individual law enforcement agencies, right? And that is not new. I can't take credit for this idea, but I want to repeat it because it's so important. These predictive policing systems, these data surveillance systems, they don't create new problems. They magnify old problems, and they make old problems exponential. They almost superpower the old problems by digitizing them and disseminating them more quickly and using a lot more data to create them. But these systems can draw their history all the way back to lantern laws 200 years ago that surveilled Black people and forced certain people to identify themselves. They can backtrack themselves all the way to data taken from people coming here from other countries on various ships and used to discriminate against them, right? Throughout time. Ever since we have collected data, ever since government agencies have collected data or surveilled people, tracked people, they've done so with bias, and those decisions and the way the tracking and surveillance has been done has always led to discriminatory behavior, right? When you have data about people, it's very easy to categorize people. It's very easy to make lists of who deserves what, who has access to what. And unfortunately, that is a practice as old as government systems, right? So these are definitely not new.
In her 2015 book, Dark Matters on the Surveillance of Blackness, Professor Simone Brown argues that lantern laws are an early example of this sort of supervisory technology. She urges us to look at the past to ask critical questions about our present.
There are lantern laws that required that Black, mixed race, or Indigenous people, if they were to walk around the city after dark and they weren't in the company of some white person, they would need to have with them a lit lantern as they moved about the city. If not, they could be taken up, arrested, and put in the galls until some owner, quote unquote, will come and get them. They could also be subject to beatings.
But the way that these digital systems perpetuate these biases and these issues and these types of discrimination and the harm that the discrimination causes, right? The disparate treatment is I don't want to say terrifying because that sounds hyperbolic, but it's very concerning because digital systems have the power to to make such big decisions so quickly. And people have a tendency to rely on digital systems. Like if a predictive policing system spits out 10 names and you look at those 10 names, it's very easy to make these people are likely to commit a crime or these people should be surveilled without much thought about it, you know, without much critical thinking. It's a very easy way for law enforcement and other entities to make assumptions about people. And it's very efficient and easy to use. There's this system that was being used in Colorado. It's called LexisNexis Lumen. And I guess what it did was it allowed the law enforcement agencies, it allowed police officers to use their phone on the street. So if they saw somebody walking and they thought that person looked suspicious, they could just snap a picture of that person. And then LexisNexis Lumen would run that image through a collection of booking photos of people who had been booked for crimes, not charged with crimes, but merely brought into the station or photographed. And it could match the face with, you know, the booking photo. And the government shut that program down. They said, you know what, we're going to put a hold on this. This seems really discriminatory. People are complaining about how discriminatory that is. And the law enforcement agents, when they were asked about how they felt about LexisNexis Lumen being taken away, they were like, ugh, we can't wait to get LexisNexis Lumen back because it was so convenient. It was so easy to use, right? These digital systems are so easy to use and convenient, and they make policing feel so easy that it's easy to imagine a world where they become ubiquitous and they end up being the decision makers.
So let's talk about racial capitalism. In the words of Angela Davis,
capitalism is racial capitalism.
So one thing the government hasn't done to this point, it hasn't developed its own technology, right? It very much relies on tech companies to build its infrastructure, right? Its email systems or Google email systems or whatever. So these private enterprises have become entrenched in government work, and they've become kind of the undergirding of a lot of our government systems, and they're profit driven. You know, I think one of the biggest problems with LexisNexis, Thomson Reuters, you know, Palantir, all of these companies is they're publicly traded corporations. And they depend on, I don't know if Palantir is publicly traded. I don't want to say that whether it is or not, because I'm not sure. But a lot of these enterprises are beholden to their shareholders. They have to continue making profits, right? The line has to go up, 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 profit, 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 more, more, more. And companies that have a mindset like that want more and more customers, want more and more profit, regardless of where that money is coming from, right? There's not much room for ethics or ethical thought in this, the line must go up kind of model, right? So the government, like LexisNexis, gets a great deal with ICE. That's wonderful for LexisNexis. That's wonderful for its shareholders. But where's the part where we stop and we think about the ethical implications of using that kind of data service in, you know, an immigration enforcement enterprise, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't leave room for the ethical conversations that we need to be having.
Do you think part of the problem is that these algorithmic systems are being treated by us as truly intelligent systems?
I think that's half the problem, but I don't think it's all the problem. I think it is half the problem when we treat these systems as they are truly intelligent. And I think it's very easy to be wowed. I know I was wowed by ChatGPT, and as was everybody else when it came out. And it is incredible. And when these systems were introduced to police in the 1990s and even the early 2000s, when they saw what these systems could do with data, it was a similar moment of, oh my God, I can't believe that this exists. Because some intelligence, whatever you want to call it, had pulled together all this information that otherwise a police officer would have to go down and track down herself or himself very painstakingly, making all these phone calls to different agencies, doing all these things to get all this information. And yet, boom, there it was on the screen. No more, you don't have to subpoena someone, you don't have to get warrants. It's just all there. And that moment of wow is something that I think caused a lot of problems, because they saw then, as we now see with the current crop of AI, these incredible things that these machines can do, and they are truly incredible. And the other thing is that the systems, however good they are or not good, they are also themselves imbalanced, because they reflect and accelerate and amplify, I think, the existing imbalances in society. And so predictive policing is a very good example of this. And some of these products are complicit in this, is that they're sort of the feedstock for these predictive policing programs. And, you know, the obvious example being where you have a neighborhood that is over-policed, very often a Black neighborhood, and that the computer sees that, well, there's this high instance of crime there. Well, yes, maybe there is, because there, or maybe there's a high instance of documented crime, but because it's the garbage in, garbage out problem. If you show that there have been a ton of arrests in this one neighborhood, well, by golly, the computer's going to recommend that you send more police to that neighborhood to stop all those crimes that are happening. And then that will reflect more, yet more arrests. And it's just going to be, eventually it's a snake eating its own tail, where it's just creating garbage and spewing out garbage. And I think that's another danger, is the amplification of these things that were originally our sort of our human original sin. The machines are very good at speeding those up. And so that's separate than us trusting them. If we didn't trust them, that would maybe break down that chain a little bit, but it doesn't make it, it doesn't fix it.
Man, this feels pretty heavy. It feels like we're caught in this endless cycle of technological challenges and racial disparities. Is there a way out of this?
Of course. We need to think beyond the tech fate. Scholars like Ruha Benjamin are urging us to ditch techno-determinism and explore new perspectives. The problem, in Ruha Benjamin's words, is
that technology is the driver, and that what's missing is a critical understanding of what's happening behind the screen. What are the human decisions, values, insights, ideologies that are becoming materialized in our hardware and our software? And so, as a first step in reimagining the relationship of technology and society, we have to actually understand the relationship rather than assume that particular types of technological innovation are inevitable. Because the more we think of them as inevitable, the less likely we are to question, to push back, and to demand better.